Welcome to Studio 2 on a Thursday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Mark Eichmann, in for Avi Wolfman Arendt. Coming up, we cannot ignore the heat outside, whether we want to or not. And the fact is some neighborhoods are hit harder than others by that heat. Climate Central just released a new study that showed a significant difference between urban and suburban temperatures, part of the heat islands phenomenon. We want to hear from you.
Yeah, and that's right. How are you dealing with all this heat? What do you want to know about extreme temperatures? Email us at studio2@whyy.org. Again, that's studio2@whyy.org. By the way, Mark, I'm so excited to be working with you today.
I'm very happy to be here.
So we're going to also talk about the potential for a Roosevelt Boulevard subway extension in a few minutes. A lot of people are really passionate about getting that increased public transit, but it's low on the priority list for others. We'll get the latest from Jay Arzu, who will join us live right here in Studio 2.
And Tanya Pendleton has some suggestions for events to check out this weekend, too, in the heat, yes.
Uh-huh.
But first, Cherry, I've done the show before. Listen at noon, of course. I know it's time to look at some of our top stories. What do we got?
Yeah, and one story I really liked. It's exciting. The city's Philadelphia annual International Unity Cup will get its first women's soccer tournament. My history with the Unity Cup goes back to 2016. It was designed to celebrate the diversity of Philadelphia neighborhoods. I used to cover the Unity Cup, and it's a soccer World Cup like tournament over the course of several months, and teams represent different countries. They were supposed to bring in a women's division back in 2020, but then you know what happened. The pandemic hit. The tournament, while it is run by the city, it is privately funded, and so they had to get a new sponsor. The city has not revealed yet who that new sponsor is, but it said it will announce once the patron, quote, is back from Australia. So, hint, hint, we'll see what's going on with that. But this was announced this Wednesday in West Philly. This will be the 8th Unity Cup, but the first time women are actually going to be playing and have their own division. It's pretty good.
Soccer's having a really big moment in the city with the international teams coming in this past weekend. Mm-hmm. I was at some of those games, and to see it's such a world sport.
It is.
And to see that celebrated in the city, and now to even expand to a women's division in that, is going to be really exciting this fall.
And full disclosure, friends, I am not a huge soccer person. You could look at me and probably tell. However, Unity Cup games are really cool because it brings all sorts of neighborhoods together. Folks speak in all sorts of languages. The food is really amazing. And it's just really cool. And I have to say, I love that the ladies are getting involved. Their games begin September 9th. The championship games for both the men's and women's divisions are scheduled for October 14th.
And
so
that's
you
the time.
Check it out. And it's all free.
And that's the time to be playing soccer.
It is.
In the fall.
Oh, yeah.
Not right now. I was at the games over the weekend, and it was hot, and it's even hotter now. So that takes us to our next top story is the heat, of course, and I know we'll get into that a little bit later in the hour. But what's a better way to cool off than jumping into one of the
city's public
pools? But unfortunately, despite a lot of efforts earlier in the year to fully staff lifeguards at these pools, there's another lifeguard shortage. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've talked about this in years past a lot. There's a feature in the New York Times really highlighting the problem in city pools, again, of not all of them being open. And neighbors are frustrated.
Yeah.
Rightly so, especially as we're enduring, 100-degree heat index over this next couple of days. So it's really a tough issue to solve, I guess, to get enough lifeguards to get in charge of these pools and to keep an eye on the kids.
And what's so crazy is the city has done everything they can. I mean, they've thrown bonuses. And I mean, these are like $1,000 bonuses at it. They're paying really well. But you think about it, the pools have been not really fully opened. And in order to learn how to swim, you kind of need access to a pool. So if you're a kid in some of these neighborhoods, your pools haven't been opened, you are not qualified to be a lifeguard because you probably don't know how to swim very well.
Right. And despite the city offering training, if you don't know how to swim to begin with, you're not going to even sign up for the extra to be a lifeguard if you're not in that situation. So it really is kind of that systemic problem baked into the history of not having pools open as consistently as the city would like. has led us to this point where we're again seeing pools closed, and it highlighted in the New York Times this kind of frustration for these people.
Yeah, it's interesting when the New York Times is doing a Philly focused story. It's like it's a pretty big deal. And another thing that's a pretty big deal is Equal Pay Day. Right, today is Equal Pay Day for Black women. That means it takes until today during the year for a Black woman to earn a salary equal to her white non-Hispanic male counterpart. Now, it's shocking for some people to think about that, but in Pennsylvania, Black women earn about 60 cents on every dollar to their white male counterparts. That's a gap of about $25,799 each year for more than 218,000 plus Black women across the state.
Those are really big numbers. Yeah. And to think about how far we are into the year is almost mind blowing.
Yeah, it sounds kind of shocking. Yeah. And what's interesting is that, you know, Latinas earn about 55 cents on the dollar. So it takes even longer for Latinas to catch up. But there is legislation, the Equal Pay Act of 1973 prohibits men and women to be paid differently. Yet these disparities still exist.
Yeah, I guess that's a difficult thing to enforce if you don't know what person down the hall who is a man or is a different is different than you is making. If you don't know that, then how do you know
that you can
enforce this Equal Pay Act of 63?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why there's big push for pay transparency. There's also a push in many states, including Delaware and New Jersey and New York, for employers to not ask you how much you used to make, because you end up stuck because they usually base your offer on your salary history.
Right.
So now it's
limited yourself to what you're able to earn at the new company if they know you've earned less at the old company.
So there we go. But there's a big push now for pay transparency. And, you know, people feel a little squiggly about that. They don't want to tell you how much they make, yet people are still doing it secretly and kind of off the record. So.
Yeah, and I think the more transparency you get, obviously, the more information. We're about news and information here. I think that's the better it could be.
Exactly, and we're talking food now.
Yeah, a real shift here.
Yeah,
I was not a lima bean person when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. At all, no matter what my mom set the timer and said to get finish this plate of lima beans. And I know there's a lot of lima bean haters out there like me, but USDA is now working to change the image of the lowly lima bean and make them a little bit more palatable to people like me.
Okay. They're also known as butter beans.
Which I didn't know.
Yeah. And we called them butter beans when I was growing up. Apparently, they're very nutritious, which is why your mom probably tried to make you eat them. They're beneficial for farming and the soil, and they hold up in the weather. That's why they want people to eat these lima beans. I will tell you that my mom put ham in the butter beans, and I thought they were delicious.
That could have changed the game for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like you think about Brussels sprouts, which were not sexy.
Same thing.
You throw some bacon, and you saute some butter sprouts, put some olive oil in there.
I know it's a big thing in you know, popular restaurants now, Brussels sprouts, but I still have those memories from childhood of not liking the Brussels sprouts.
They're delicious. And so talking about change of perception, like people kind of shifting their perspective about things, it's a perfect pivot to our newsmaker. The recent collapse and ongoing repair of Interstate 95 in Northeast Philly sounded the alarm once again for the need for expanded mass transit expanded mass transit access along Roosevelt Boulevard. And it got some city council members to step up and push efforts to reconsider a plan for a Roosevelt Boulevard subway extension. And we have someone who is a very strong advocate of that extension here with us. J.R. Zhu is a doctoral student of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania Stuart Weitzman School of Design. And he's here in Studio 2. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Cherry. Thank you, Mark, for having me. It's great to be here.
Jay, thanks for being here. You know, this project was essentially dead, and somehow it was resurrected. And I guess that's sort of the history of this project, of being kind of resurrected and talked about over the years. Tell us about the project and why you think now is the perfect time for that resurrection to bring this back.
So to be as brief as possible, the city of Philadelphia has gone through, in a sense, a boom and bust with the Roosevelt Boulevard subway, where every 10 to 20 years, they revisit the idea of building the subway and they recognize that it's something that should be done, but then due to funding or other pressing issues at the time, the can is further, you know, kicked down the road. So what we're trying to do is to stop kicking the can down the road and at the same time create tens of thousands of jobs, creating the subway and better connecting Northeast Philadelphia to other opportunities throughout the region and vice versa. The time is now to get it done.
Yeah, so let's talk about the project for folks who may not have heard about it. Explain what the problem is that it seeks to solve and what the project will look like.
Right. So when you look at a map of Philadelphia today and look at a SEPTA map, you see that the majority of the region is connected to either the heavy rail lines, which are, you know, the Market Frankford line or the Broad Street line or regional rail lines. But when you look at the northeast section of Philadelphia, you see that there's two regional rail lines that skirt the region, but the center of the region where the majority of people live along Roosevelt Boulevard is not well serviced. And that's something that transportation planners have noticed for decades and why they continue to, in a sense, every 20 years, repropose it, because it is a massive transportation inequity. There's 500,000 people that live in Northeast and don't have access to rapid transit. And building the Roosevelt Boulevard subway would move to solve that problem. It would be a 15-mile extension of the Broad Street subway with a 1-mile extension of the Market Frankford line to meet the Broad Street extension at Busselton. So that'd be a major transportation hub there. But it would be transformative and it would cut congestion on the boulevard and at the same time reduce travel times from people coming from Northeast by up to half an hour. So this is transformational.
And I guess the biggest question mark and maybe some of the biggest pushback against this, SEPTA CEO Leslie Richards was on Studio 2 a couple of months ago, you know, and she said the project isn't feasible because of the cost, because of the budget. And I think that's something that SEPTA is dealing with on a whole lot of other issues as well. Is that a legitimate kind of holdback on this? Because it's expensive.
That's true. First of all, we don't know how expensive it is until PennDOT comes out with updated numbers, which they'll be doing this fall. Second, there are federal programs that we could utilize to help pay for the project. There's, of course, the capital investment grants that we could use that would pay up to 50% of the project. But to do that, we have to meet our local match. And to be able to do that, we need more localized funding for SEPTA. So that's something that's being worked on in the PA House right now that would give SEPTA and other transportation agencies a way to find more localized funding. But it's very possible. It may not seem possible today, but give it, you know, we get the localized funding and we use these different grants and discretionary grants and programs from the Federal Transit Administration. It is very affordable, surprisingly.
Yeah. And so, you know, there has been this stop start for more than 100 years. I want you to briefly tell me, like, I mean, it started out in 1913. There were people who were gung-ho about this project, skipped a few decades, came back 48, 60s, 70s, getting into the 2000s. I mean, why is this zigzag going on with this project?
So at least with the first few proposals in the 1910s, unfortunately, due to World War One, the U.S. entry into World War One, that didn't happen. And then looking back at 48, what people don't recognize is that at the time, after World War II, in downtown Philadelphia, the Market Frankford subway, which is now in use, but at that time, it was actually mothballed and not fully used, so they had to bring that back into, you know, they had to fix that. But at the same time, now the Locust subway, which is now used by Patco, was also abandoned. So there was a lot of abandoned subways in downtown Philadelphia that had to be, you know, actually brought back, which they were by the mid-50s. So after that was done,
yeah,
you know, there was a study that literally came out in 1960 and, you know, spoke about the idea of the subway in the median of a new Northeast Expressway. So looking at the 1960s and 70s proposal, it would have been like what they have in Chicago, where the trains are in the middle of a massive expressway. But ultimately, there was community opposition to the expressway. And I think that that was more of the reason why that wasn't done then. But then subsequently, Mayor Frank Rizzo had to choose between the Roosevelt Boulevard subway and the Center City Connector, which is, you know, how the commuter rail lines go through Center City.
And so there's always been an issue, it seems like,
right,
year after year after year. But now, after I-95, the focus is again, and City Council wants to at least look at it.
Yes, and they unanimously passed the resolution to have hearings. So, you know, that initial vote wasn't supposed to happen to the fall. They were going to vote in the fall to have hearings, but they recognized the need, the City Council, and they passed the resolution so that we could start having these hearings and bringing together community members to have further conversations about why the subway is needed and just to give opinions. We want the public to come out, and this is going to be happening in either late September or early October. We're going to have a few hearings.
Are you confident that the political will that moved those votes up will be enough to sort of keep this going as the months move on from what happened in 95?
I'm deadly confident. And I'll tell you why. When people start to see the numbers come out for the subway project, the amount of daily riders, the amount of jobs, the tens of thousands of jobs that a project this size could create, you know, I think that it's going to open up a lot of eyes. People who may be not fully on board now will get on board.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We'll leave it there. You've been listening to Jay Arzu, a very strong advocate of the Roosevelt Boulevard Subway Extension Project. Thanks so much for being here, Jay. Coming up next, hot, hot heat islands and their effect on urban communities. Email us, studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Studio 2, and I'm Cherry Gregg. To say it's hot today would be an understatement. Temperatures have gotten so extreme in so many regions that President Joe Biden is announcing new measures aimed at helping communities deal with the scorching heat. Those are expected to improve forecasting, ensure access to drinking water, and extend protection to workers most vulnerable to heat-related deaths. At the same time, a new report from Climate Central shows that cities can be more than 12 degrees hotter at their core than surrounding areas with different infrastructure and more green spaces. It makes hotter days even more unbearable, and due to climate change, it will get worse without action. Here to explain heat islands and how to make cities cooler is Caitlin Trudeau. She is a senior research associate at Climate Central. Caitlin, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we want to hear from you. We want to know what you think about the extreme heat. Email your questions and comments to studio2@whyy.org. Again, the email is studio2@whyy.org. So, Caitlin, we're going to jump right in. For folks who may not know, can you explain to us what an urban heat island is?
Yeah, definitely. So when we talk about urban heat islands, what we're really talking about are cities that experience significantly warmer temperatures than the surrounding rural areas. So you can think of it like a little heat dome that sits over our most populated parts of the city.
And so Climate Central did a study looking at heat islands across the country. Explain the scope of the study and what you all found.
Yeah, so what we did is we looked at the 44 most populated cities in the United States, and we looked to see how many people are impacted by this additional heat that is caused by the urban heat island effect. And what we found is that about 41 million Americans are living in places where the city infrastructure and materials make it at least 8 degrees warmer than if the city were built differently, than it would be outside the city. So a lot of people are living in areas with a lot of additional heat that makes it really hard when we have these, you know, increased temperatures, more frequent heat waves that are happening because of climate change.
Yeah. And I want to zoom out a bit because part of the problem, and you touched on it in your answer there, is just how the cities are built and designed. Can you explain
Absolutely.
A little bit about what the issues are that lead cities to have this excessive heat?
Yeah. So one of the things is the materials that we use to build our city. So when we built our cities, we replaced a lot of vegetation and natural landscape with hard, dark-colored materials to build our streets and our buildings. So things like asphalt, concrete, brick, these materials are really good at absorbing incoming heat from the sun, and they radiate it back out to the surrounding environment, making it warmer. And what's unfortunate is because we replaced the green space actually helps cool the city by reflecting more of the incoming solar radiation. So as we build more dark colored hard materials that trap in that heat, but then also how we build our cities matters too. So the dimensions and spacing of our buildings can make a big difference. Cities with lots of tall buildings, cities with narrow streets, those are better at trapping heat in and also blocking natural air wind flow. So it's not only what our cities are built and made of, but how we build them as well.
Yeah. And can you go into a little bit more depth? Because I want you to sort of give me an example. And we have, you know, Philadelphia is a heat island, so to speak. Give me an example of the differences between the way you would see a suburb designed and built that mm-hmm. makes it a little bit cooler versus what you would see in an urban center.
Right. So in our urban centers, we have really tall buildings. We've got narrow streets. We've got a lot of people. That's another thing too, our human activity. You know, we release a lot of pollution from driving our cars, from factories, and even from using things like our air conditioners. Those things all warm the city even further. You know, out in the suburbs, you're probably gonna have not as tall buildings. You're probably gonna have more green space, more area for green space. And you know, you're probably gonna have wider streets, where areas where basically the air can flow more freely and evenly and not get trapped like in big cities.
Yeah. And I just mentioned that Philadelphia is a heat island. And so I want to bring in one of our folks on the ground here in the city by introducing Jamile Telez Lieberman, Senior Vice President of Development, Research and Health Equity at Esperanza. Welcome to Studio 2, Jamile.
Thank you for having me.
And so it's hot here in Philly today. And I know there's a lot of work being done to mitigate urban heat island effect here in our own backyard. But before we talk about that, the Philadelphia Department of Health issued a heat health emergency. Can you explain to me what that means for the folks in our neighborhoods and how will that heat health emergency declaration help them?
Yeah, so I remember seeing that declaration go out. And I also got a text. I got an email and a text about that. And so first, I just want to flag that both of those messages that came to me were in English. Mm. And so that's an interesting thing we can talk about in terms of language access to information. But, you know, I think that, you know, the emergency warning means the same thing for all of us, but also different things for some of us, because it's true, all of us in the city are going to be suffering due to these sweltering temperatures, and it's going to raise the risks of heat-related illnesses across the city. But we know that there are some neighborhoods that when it gets hot, they get much hotter than other neighborhoods. So the neighborhood that we serve, Hunting Park, Juniata, Feltonville up here in North Philly, in terms of Nueva Esperanza Inc.'s service area, is one of the hottest neighborhoods in the city, you know, regardless of the general trends in temperature. And that's due to the built environment, redlining, and lack of tree canopy. So for our folks up here, the risks in terms of heat-related illnesses like heat exhaustion, heat stroke, as well as just general uncomfortableness, right, are going to be much more profoundly felt here than in other neighborhoods like Westmount Area or Chestnut Hill, right? So it is really going to be extremely, extremely hot here.
Yeah.
And our neighbors are going to feel it. They're really going to feel it, and they're going to have to contend with that. And then there's other mitigating factors here in terms of access to cooling, which we can talk about if we want that to be part of the conversation, that is going to make it more difficult for them to cope with these more extreme temperatures.
Yeah. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about heat islands, and Philadelphia is one of those. We have on the line with us Caitlin Trudeau, Senior Research Associate at Climate Central, a nonprofit that published a recent study on heat islands. We also have Jamale Telez Lieberman, SVP of Development at Esperanza. And if we want to hear from you as well, be part of the conversation. Email us your comments, questions, or concerns at studio2@whyy.org. Caitlin, I want to give you a moment to respond to what Jamale just said. I mean, this is happening everywhere. And you heard about some of the impacts that this excessive heat is having on folks in neighborhoods like Hunting Park. How is this impacting residents of other cities who are grappling with these heat islands?
Well, we're seeing a lot of the same things. I mean, we're seeing that some of the places that are the warmest are often in the neighborhoods where you have a lot of low-income population, you have a lot of people of color, people who maybe can't afford air conditioning as easily as other people. So we're really seeing a disproportionate impact on peoples in the cities as well, which is really concerning because, you know, everything she said, all of the related heat impacts are going to increase, as we have more pollution, it's going to warm our cities as well. People with asthma, it's going to cause a lot more increased health impacts across the city. But we're seeing this all across the United States. It's not something that's just in one part of the U.S. We're seeing it all over. I mean, at least 9 cities we looked at had at least 1 million people that are exposed to this additional 8 degrees temperature at all times. So it's really concerning because we have a lot of people who are at risk and a lot of people who may not be able to respond or adapt as easily as others.
Yeah. And Jamale, you've been quoted as saying it's almost like our neighborhood was designed this way. I want you to get specific and tell us what are some of the issues that has led to this problem and continue to make it hard for residents to combat this heat.
Sure. Quickly, I do want to make a correction to my title. I'm SVP of Community Engagement, Research, and Health Equity here at Esperanza. The SVP of Development is Christine Nieves, actually. And I oversee the Housing Economic Development Division, which is the community engagement arm for the institution, as well as the new Institute for Latino Health Equity. So I just wanted to put that on the record real quick.
Thank you for that.
So yes. Of course. When we talk about why things are hot, why is it so hot up here? It's really by design, right? And so to get specific, our neighborhood, as opposed to other neighborhoods in the city, and this is true for cities across the country, which I'm sure Caitlin can comment on, has been victimized in terms of lack of investment and racist housing policies and development policies, like redlining. Displacement of communities of color being pushed out of their original neighborhoods farther north in the city. And this is in terms of Philadelphia, right? And so what that means is that they end up being pushed by different mechanisms, including, housing policies, displacement, and other things into neighborhoods that were not necessarily made ready to welcome people. We have a lot of residents up here who are living in a neighborhood that's very industrial. So there's a lot of asphalt, there's a lot of pavement, and that attracts heat. It does not reflect it. And then also in terms of trees, our neighborhood doesn't get a lot of trees. Esperanza has worked for many, many years to increase the tree canopy for our neighborhood, alongside many amazing grassroots groups and also some organizations at the city level to try to increase our tree canopy to invest in some more longer term cooling strategies. But at the same time, knowing that the needs are so critical at this time and they're only going to get worse, we're also, looking at other more immediate solutions in terms of heat mitigation and for people to be able to cope to heat. So really what it comes down to is issues of race, issues of class, issues of color, issues of where money is going and where resources are going and to who. And our community continues to lose out. Our community, which is a community of color and mostly low income, as well as having a lot of a growing number of immigrants from other countries. So I think that's really what it boils down to. But I also think that there are ways that we can address that.
Yeah. And I want to mention that you in the introduction, I talked about how President Biden is expected to announce new measures and funding designed to help communities deal with extreme heat. And Caitlin, I want to ask you, what are some of the things that can be put in place infrastructure wise that can help? I mean, Jamale talked about, you know, tree canopies and other opportunities to bring in cooling. Cooling measures, what are some of the infrastructure opportunities here?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the number one thing is increasing green space, right? Trees, vegetation. One of the things I think is really great is changing what our building rooftops are. You know, they're usually black, dark surfaces. If you can add greenery to the tops of roofs, it actually reflects a lot of that solar radiation. They have rooftop gardens, eco roofs, even just a layer of plants, shrubs. You can also paint rooftops white, and white and bright colored rooftops actually reflect a lot of the incoming solar radiation. So they cool the building inside and make it so less people have to use air conditioning. So really changing the tops of our roofs. We really can't rebuild our cities that are already built, but we can make some changes like changing our rooftops, like adding more trees, more vegetation, and using smarter building materials, using cool pavements, paving materials on sidewalks and parking lots that remain cooler than conventional pavements. And just thinking about how, you know, how we build our cities from now on, if we need to build more of our cities, and if we do, how to do so smartly in ways that will reduce the urban heat island effect.
Thank you very much. And speaking of solutions and people on the ground getting the work done, I want to bring in Mika Outlaw, a community activist and founder of Residents Organized for Advocacy and Direction, who's working to help cool down her neighborhood of Grays Ferry. Welcome to Studio 2, Mika.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yes. And I want to just, you're doing the work of trying to cool your neighborhood. And you've said when you kind of realized that it wasn't normal for areas outside the city to be cooler with fresher air than those in the city to have thicker, heavier air and to be so warm. So you got to work. Tell me about the work you're doing to help cool things off.
Well, right now we're actually, and I'm really excited about this, we're working in partnership with Drexel University on a cooling project where two blocks in Grays Ferry, one of them being the 2600 block of Ophir Street and two blocks in Point Breeze, they 15 residents per block received planter benches, benches that were made by people from the community with vegetation in it and an umbrella. And it allows for people to come sit outside, especially if you live on the sunny side of the street. My aunt lives on the sunny side of the street. So when she wants to come sit outside, she has to chase the shade. And what I mean by that is the shade is on one side of the street. And so when it moves, she has to move. And now with her having this planter bench, it allows for her to be able to sit out there on the sunny side of the street. And the temperature under the umbrella is not as hot for her. And she's able to sit out. So I'm really excited about that project. We've also been working with Mr. Maurice and Ahmad Amalki from the Clean Water Organization. And we had the Office of the Philadelphia Office of Sustainability.
And Mika, I think
you're dealing with.
Yeah, and Mika, I think our connection with you is a little tenuous. We're probably going to have to wrap this up, but you're doing work with the, and I couldn't hear the last thing you said. Okay, I think we lost Mika. Again, that was Mika Outlaw. She's an activist working to help cool off her neighborhood, Point Breeze. Grays Ferry, excuse me. A lot of work being done on the ground. John Millay, I want to bring you back in to talk about some of the work that you all have been doing as well. And you heard me mention to Caitlin some of this effort by the Biden administration to provide funds, to provide some new measures. What do you think you need to help make a difference, especially as we deal with climate change?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, especially since my division in particular at Esperanza are also activists on the ground. Especially my staffer, Ivana Gonzalez, who leads some of our environmental justice initiatives. So that's a good question. I loved some of the suggestions that Caitlin mentioned, sort of altering the built environment in ways that are smart and efficient, painting roofs. I think that's, those innovative solutions are great, but then also like we have to think about how we do that equitably. So it's you're just doing it smartly, right? Mm-hmm. Innovation, and then also equitable. So like, how do we go about doing those kinds of changes? Because, we should not expect our community members who are struggling to pay their utility bills and to put food on the tables to pay for that, to repaint their roofs, right? So I think that it's important to consider sort of like the allocation of resources, where the resources are going and who they're going to, and what are those resources, like what programs and what type are they funding, right? So I think the Biden administration needs to think about, we don't just want the most innovative things. We do, right? We do want science to lead what we're going to do in terms of helping to lower the temperatures in urban areas. But we also know that we can't just throw money at something and then expect it to have an effect or to have an equitable effect where families and communities and neighborhoods that are most affected by heat are the ones that are served first, right? Because the risks for those neighborhoods are higher than other neighborhoods. I mean, that's just a fact, because not all cities are cookie cutter and the same. And even in our city in Philadelphia, one block is so different from another block. Mm. And one zip code is vastly different in terms of temperature, air quality, all of that. So I think the Biden administration needs to think creatively, and they need to think equitably when it comes to things like that. And, I do think that it's tree canopy is really important. We do want to invest in that. And Esperanza has been working to do that, to lower temperatures long term and also improve air quality. But we also started thinking about weatherization of homes. And Caitlin mm-hmm. Touched on this a little bit, like how do we make homes more energy efficient, right? Yeah. Because for us, we like to look at solutions that address multiple needs at once. So if we're making a home that's more energy efficient, that has proper cooling, then people can be cooled in their homes in addition to having alternative greeting like benches, like Mika was mentioning, outside of their homes. But then they also save money in addition to being part of more pro-climate solutions, like having an energy efficient weatherized home. So I think we need to do a lot of things at once, and we need to be really careful about, who gets what resources and when they get them. And then, just trying to identify solutions that yeah. meet the realities of where communities are. One solution that might work for a neighborhood in South Philly is not necessarily going to work out for mm-hmm. a neighborhood in North Philly. And this might be the same for other cities. So I think we just need to be cognizant of that. And I hope that the Biden administration will think along those lines as they're trying to invest in reducing some of these consequences.
So reprioritization and flexibility when we talk solutions. Thank you for that. If you are just tuning in, we're talking about heat islands. Philadelphia has several neighborhoods that are heat islands. We have on the line with us Caitlin Trudeau, Senior Research Associate at Climate Central. They published a study about heat islands. We also have John Millay, Telez Lieberman, SVP of Community Engagement at Esperanza. And you just heard from Mika Outlaw, community activist working to cool down her Grays Ferry neighborhood. I want to bring in an email, and this is for you, Caitlin. It's from Warren. Over the last few years, the city has put down the darkest color imaginable in its repaving program. It's dead black. At the same time, the city is encouraging trees and things like rooftop gardens. Can repaving be executed at the same time as urban improvement? Also, similar email from Meg. Why is blacktop still being used? And I'm thinking about climate change here, Caitlin. We heard what Jamalay had to say about some of the solutions. And yet you still see cities, not just Philly, probably other cities, still using old methods to build. How are we going to tackle climate change? And what should folks be pushing for policy wise to make sure that this shift happens now?
Absolutely. I mean, I live in Sacramento, and I just yesterday saw brand new pavement going on, like right outside my apartment. And it's really upsetting because knowing how much heat is retained in these dark surfaces, it's just seems senseless. And we really do need to be prioritizing this now. We should have prioritized it yesterday, last year, last decade, last half century. We are really behind. So it is frustrating because we do need our community leaders to step up and realize that this is something that is important that we need to do now, that is for our city's health and for, yeah, definitely so many people are being disproportionately affected. It's definitely, we need to do it equitably. I think that was a great point there. And I mean, we need to be using smarter materials like cool pavements, things, you know, using the same black asphalt isn't going to help anyone. And it's going to make it more costly, more deadly to address in the future.
Yeah. And Jamalay, you focus on this. We want to talk about climate change. You mentioned that it's getting real in communities, more floods, higher electric bills, people getting sicker because of the heat. Who are you focused on and what agencies are you pushing right now to make sure that changes are prioritized for the communities you serve?
Yeah, great. Thanks for that question. So we're doing a lot of things on a lot of different fronts. We are pushing the city in terms of helping us get, you know, increase our tree canopy and also rolling out new programs for tree maintenance to keep those trees alive, right? Because just planting the trees, you know, that's if you can't keep them alive because of the heat, because the need of watering or other nuisances associated with trees that are not maintained, then you really are kind of back to square one because they do die, right? So in addition to pushing, you know, at the local level for that, we're also, we have recently produced a policy brief with Community Legal Services, another local, I think they're a statewide organization, around increasing state funding for the federal LIHEAP program, which provides people funds to support their utility bills. And so that program helps people warm their homes in the winter. Yeah. Right. Which is a climate change thing, right? Because we see more extreme temperatures on both ends, heat and cold. And what we're wanting to do is to extend the coverage of LIHEAP for Pennsylvania and Philadelphia to cover the hottest months, because right now it basically ends in April. And so they need help to cover their utility bills because people in our
And we're going to have to leave it there.
Sorry.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to say thank you so much to Caitlin Trudeau of Climate Central. Thanks for being on Studio 2. Also, thank you to Jamalay Telez Lieberman of Esperanza. I appreciate you both being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Things to do coming up next on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg, and we have reached the end of another week of our show. Can't believe it. We're at 4 months now. That means it's time for the weekend. Looking forward to it. And as always, WHYY's Tanya Pendleton has a fantastic list of things that you can do and you don't want to miss it.
When life batters you, and it happens to us all, weekends can restore you. We're here with some options to free your mind, body, and spirit. First, let's dance. Philadelphia Dance Day, the annual celebration of dance in the city, happens on Saturday. The event is spread over multiple venues in Center City within a 2-mile radius. You can try everything from ballet to ballroom in a welcoming, inclusive atmosphere. All the events are free except for the day's finale at Plays and Players, which is ticketed and features partner lessons, open dancing, and a performance. Things get started at 10 a.m. and we'll have the schedule on our website, whyy.org/things to do. Spending time in nature is another way to de-stress. Free Walkers, a national nonprofit that hosts long-distance walks, is behind Saturday's Wissahickon Trolley Trek. It starts at Chestnut Hill East Station and ends at 30th Street Station. Trekkers will explore lesser-known trails through Valley Green, the Mill-Covered Bridge, Trolley Town, the Fingerspan Bridge, Lemon Hill, and more. Organizers say this is one of their more challenging walks, so make sure your fitness level is up to par. The free trek starts at 10:30 a.m., and considering the weekend's heat forecast, make sure you bring some extra hydration.
A newly grown perfect ear of corn!
It's really corn!
Yep!
It's been resurrected and reborn!
Hallelujah!
Corn is having a moment. The Tony-winning Broadway musical Shucked is centered around it, and so is the first annual Sweet Corn Festival. It's happening on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Charlin Farms in Bucks County. Expect plenty of corny activities, including, of course, cornhole, a corn shucking contest, live music, barrel cart and pony rides, and the corn pit. Not to mention plenty of corn to eat, which always tastes amazing on a summer afternoon. Laughter is certainly good for the soul, and you'll be doing plenty of it if you head to the Heavy Hitters of Comedy show at the Keswick Theater. J. Anthony Brown, Red Grant, Faison Love, and Mark Curry are on the bill. These veteran performers have been on the circuit for a long time, so expect some ribald humor and to come out feeling better than when you came in. The show is on Saturday night at 7 p.m. You can always count on music to make the world easier to manage, and if you're an emerging local artist, this weekend may change the trajectory of your career. World Cafe Live hosts the Beta Hi-Fi Emerging Artist Festival. If I miss you, it'll change the way I kiss you. I don't wanna bore you, but I'm running out of things to say. The winner of Saturday's finale gets $500, studio and rehearsal time, and a media opportunity. If you want to root on local artists that include Alyssa Garcia, Nervous Nikki and the Chill Pills, and Baldini and the Bastards, come through. All the performances at the fest are free. And there's another free festival in town. At the Fillmore Complex, the Alt 104.5 Fishtown Festival showcases music, vendors, and craft beer. Performances by Group Love, Voila, and local contest winner Max Davey take place in the Fillmore and at Brooklyn Bowl. They will also provide free bowling between 1 and 4 p.m. Portugal, The Man, and Snack Time and the Night with a ticketed show at 8 p.m. We recommend you head to that festival early. It's going to be busy. Some songs just take you back to good times and good memories. Whatever you're doing in 1984, Karma Chameleon, it was likely the soundtrack. Run the 80s back one more time with Boy George and Culture Club. They'll be at The Man on Sunday. The show starts at 7 p.m. And we're pretty sure Anthony Hamilton will sing his big hit, Charlene, at his concert at the Met Philadelphia on Saturday. The show starts at 8. Hey, we'll run it back next Thursday when we return with more things to do.
1, 2, 3 into the folk. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the dope.
We invite you to head to our website, whyy.org/things to do, where you can find out more details about what you've heard and where Snoop and Wiz Khalifa will be in Jersey this weekend. And Broadway, it's coming to Delco. Memphis is on stage in Upper Darby. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
A little hip hop there to wrap up that segment. I have to say, I love Anthony Hamilton. The man setter has been really doing it lately. Well, friends, that is it for Studio 2 today. And my first time hosting the show without Avi. And no Thursday trivia. But both Avi and Trivia Thursday will be back the week after next. So don't worry. Well, I got to say thank you to our producers today. They are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. For more of our show, you can head on over to WHYY.org/studio2 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. From Studio 2, right here at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks so much for joining us.